It is Friday, April 12th, so of course we're talking about the IRS. I'm Jake Mintz.
And I'm Jordan Schusterman. We are, of course, going to review the latest in the Shohei Ohtani, Ipe Mizuhara saga. A lot of updates from that. And then in the second half, I think we're going to actually talk a little bit about baseball. How about that, Jake? It's Friday, so we're going to give you the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Friday, going to get down on Friday.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world, taking the over on UCLA soccer. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and we were given quite a treasure trove of information yesterday on Thursday of the Ipe Mizuhara Shohei Ohtani gambling catastrophe. Jordan, yeah. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. It is Friday. It is April 12th, as you said. The first half of this episode of Baseball Barbacast will be reviewing some government documents. Get ready, folks. We read every word of the 37-page official legal complaint, and we will be reporting back here on this here Barbacast.
And let me be clear. We had this tough conversation with our producer, Hartz, before we hopped on. If you did not read the book, I do not want to hear your takes on the book report, okay? Educate yourself. Read every word. It is like the most entertaining and interesting and compelling, sad to government document that I have ever read. It is worth reading in full.
Yes.
Read it or don't share your thoughts. That's how I feel.
Yes, and we're going to get into that. In the second half of today's show, we are going to talk about baseball, right?
This is
in the title. So as much as we are loving, you know, IRS criminal investigations and the juiciness of those, the baseball's continued on. The regular season has proceeded. There's much happening on the field we're going to get to, and it is, of course, Friday. So we will be doing the good, the bad, the ugly. Jake was at Jackson Holliday's debut. The hitless and washed, overrated Jackson Holliday. He was at his debut.
20 years old and washed.
The Orioles, not washed. Oh, boy. But anyway, we'll get to all that in the second half. Obviously, the first half of the show, we have a lot to get to here. And, you know, I think before we get into this, I think the first place to start is wow, it's April 12th, and we already sort of have some level of resolution here. I think we maybe assumed that this level of federal investigation and all the levels to it and everybody involved, it was gonna drag on and on and on. We know that the original federal investigation involving this illegal bookmaking operation had been going on for months already, and so I was like, oh man, this could take a while. And instead, we have some amount of closure, which we are going to get into. Now, Jake,
yeah,
as you mentioned at the top, this is a public government document. Usually it's not super fun to go to things .gov. That's not normally where we're spending our time.
However, this is .org, but
okay. Yes. Well, I saw a few different URLs that included .gov. But the point is, this document, which came with the timeline of this coming out, was we had some initial reporting earlier this week from the New York Times, which was basically like, Ipe is pleading guilty. Okay.
Yeah.
And then it was like, because we have this extremely detailed federal investigation, this federal complaint filed by an IRS special agent, And this is a public document that you can access right now. You can, if you haven't read it yet, you can stop the podcast. You can see it's been linked in many of the ESPN reporting and whatnot. And I will say this, Jake, this, when I saw that this was publicly available, I started to see the excerpts and I saw it was 37 pages. This was the opposite of the meme where it's like someone gets a long text and they say, happy for you, or sorry, I ain't reading all that though. Happy for you, or sorry that happened. This was the opposite. I was like, I am reading every word of this. I don't care whether it makes me happy or sad. This is going to be something I need to read, and not just because it's my job to talk about this and not sound like a total dunce, but also because it's like, for so much of this, you know, we've been limited to not just the these, you know, changing stories from both sides. I wanted to read something that was an official legal document from people who have been interviewing sources, who people who have been investigating this for months and know every side of the story and are putting it in official terms here. And that is what we have. And so while we are going to go through what we found out here, if you read all 37 pages of this and you're still coming away from this being like, I don't know, like, I can't help you. Like, that's fine. Well, but I can't, I don't really know what, where to go from there.
A couple different things. Number one, Special Agent Chris Seymour 8. He went in, dude. Like, I, that was one takeaway. Let Seymour cook. Like, this is a very impressive thing to put together in the amount of time he had. Like, to do all the research and the interviews in, what, like 3 weeks? And right. Then write all this up? 37 pages? I understand it's double spaced and the font's big, but like, Chris Seymour.
That's so Chris true. Seymour. Not actually that impressive. He was great. It was like we've all done it in college. It's like, give him a little bit more, you know, mess with the indentation. He wasn't working on a word count. He's just trying to get us the information.
Right. This was beast behavior from Chris Seymour. So let's start there. Now, what I really want to focus on, right, is Jordan Schusterman and Jake Mintz, that's us, are going to take this document at face value. Okay. We are going to believe that everything in this that is being reported or, I guess, investigated by the IRS is true, okay? You can choose to not believe that if you'd like, and I think that is wrong. I understand rationally that the American public has lost some faith in our institutions, in American government, and I think that's reasonable, but I also think that is regrettable and sad. And I am going to choose to believe this. One, because usually these things are right. Okay. That's the first thing. Number two, the American, like the IRS and these, they don't bring these cases to like trial or to the public if they don't think they're going to win them. Right. Like they win the American government wins, like, my mom was saying this, she's a lawyer, like over 90% of the cases that they bring. Okay. Like that's the point of making this public.
Right.
And so, you know, you can read this and say, oh, well, this is, they're lying, like it's a government cover up and like Otani's guilty. I just like, I can't have a conversation with you then if like that's where you're coming from, because then what do we believe?
Right. Yeah, like, I just don't know where I'll get burned.
You're like, maybe I'll get burned and this is all a huge cover up. And if that's the case, like, fine. Mm-hmm. Like I'll take that L. But I'm just going to believe that everything, you know, his legend, his highness, Chris Seymour rolled out in this is fact.
Well, and that, again, you know, along those lines, like I just, there is a lot in here that is absolutely, as an adjective, unbelievable. Like there are details in here that are like difficult to fathom. There's a difference between that and just being like, nah, it's BS. Like, no way. Like, there's clearly something fishy. Like, because at this point, with this level where we're at and where we know that Ipe's basically surrendering to the government, that is already happening. You know, that's expected to happen next. And you have parts in here at the end, you know, sorry, spoiler, where he says, yeah, I stole from him, right? I don't know what else you're hoping to see, because this is heading towards a legal resolution. So if the people that want to still treat it as, oh, he's a fall guy, Shohei's still, you know, guilty, all these things, if you're just going to be every time you turn on the TV and you're looking at Shohei like, this guy's dirty. Like, I don't know. That's fine. I just don't know what to tell these people. So, okay. All right. So all those caveats aside, So I'm glad we said that, because all we can do is take this very thorough legal document that is based on so many hours of investigation and clear and reviewing of thousands of text messages between Ipe and Shohei, between all of these things. It's all in there. We are going to go off of that information. And so what we are going to do now is say what we have learned from this document.
One more caveat. I said this last time. There are aspects of this that are funny. And there are also a lot of aspects of this that are incredibly sad. Gambling addiction is an addiction, right? It should be treated seriously. However, it is like also somewhat comical that Ipe was like, well, you know, I also lost a lot of money on crypto last year. Like that, yeah. Both of those things are true. And we will try and thread that needle.
Yeah. So, okay. So now the other important thing, and you say, all right, well, back to how do we get here? And wow, this is amazing that they did all this to begin, how they did this so quickly, is that it really hasn't only just been the last 2 weeks, right? And the reason that we really originally got here is that this illegal bookmaker who was already under investigation because the IRS and the FBI is coming after all these illegal bookies that are in states where it is not legal, this bookmaker had his stuff seized in October of last year, all right? And once that happens, that is how we start to, when we're going through all his stuff, and when I say me and my buddy Chris Seymour, we're digging through this illegal bookmaker's phone and all of his records and all his contact info. That is what eventually leads us to Ipe. And that, once that was uncovered, that is how people start digging into a connection. It's like, Ipe, oh, you mean the guy that's always with the most famous baseball player in the world? We should probably look into that. And that is how we start going through that part of it.
So okay. I'm just going to hop in. All right. Mm-hmm. Here are some things. Number one, Ipe was there to help Ohtani set up this specific bank account through which payments were made to the illegal bookmaking operation. That bank account, like we kind of theorized, was set up in March of 2018 when Ohtani first came over to the States. And it is certain that Ipe was with Ohtani when that bank account was set up. Like, right? Like,
we know that. Yeah.
We know that. Like, he was there to translate. Ipe is there for every moment. But then Ipe changes the bank account contact information to Ipe's own information so that any and all communication from the bank is going through Ipe and not through Ohtani. Okay. Which really does help explain part of why Ohtani did not know what was going on.
Right. So you're skipping ahead a little bit, because what's important is that does not happen initially. And when they review what happens with this account, there is no online activity from 2018 to 2021. There is no accessing. It is basically just whenever the Angels pay him, that's the money that's going in. There's no money going out. It is a very straightforward bank account. In 2021, in late October 2021, September, October 21, when Ipe gets connected with this illegal bookie through whatever means and starts gambling, that is when it is understood that Ipe first transferred money from this account that belonged to Ohtani to the illegal bookmaker. And that is when he changed the contact information to his own, or some sort of facsimile of his own that was able to fool the bank into thinking that it was still his. So that's when it's like, oh, okay, now we start seeing there's stuff changing and there's stuff, money coming out of this that was never coming out before.
But it's also not like the email address was ipe.mizuhara. Like, he made it like Shohei Ohtani 5, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's understood that it was believable that it could have been Ohtani's account.
Yes. And the other thing about this is, you say, okay, well, how in the world, how could you possibly call the bank and whatnot? And how could you make that happen? So apparently in February of 2022, again, so this is a few months into when he's already, we'll go back to like where the gambling starts to spiral. February 2022 is when he really starts to try and move like serious money out of Shohei's account transfer it to the bookie. And the bank originally is like, no, that's not happening. And they freeze his account. At which point he contacts the bank directly and impersonates Ohtani with the security questions, with everything. They have the records. They have the phone calls of this. And so if you want to say, how could you just call the bank and pretend to be someone? I mean, listen, I have that same reaction too. I'm just telling you, they listen to the phone calls with the bank and they listen to him successfully do this. So, and like that, it's clearly Ipe on the phone, right? So that is what happened.
Ipe knows the answers to Otani's security questions. Yeah. Like, you probably know the answers to my security questions, Jordan. You know what I mean?
So, again, and the big, this is the biggest takeaway that we're going to keep coming back to is, as we know, Ipe was controlling everything, and that is what Shohei wanted him to do. That is how, that is the level of trust that they had. That was the whole situation since the very beginning. Okay. So he manages to change it to his own, or to his own contact info so that he's able to transfer money along the way. However, over the course of these next year or 2 years, what we have and what the bulk of this document is essentially messages between Ipe and the bookie. And this is the part that's initially funny, because the first message that is shared is in September of 21, where, quote, Ipe texts the bookie, "I've just been messing around with soccer. There's games on 24/7, LOL. I took UCLA, but they lost outright." Again, it's like, wow, you're starting with college soccer. Like, this is already like, how is this where you're beginning your you know, your actual gambling? And we'll get to the details of like how much he ended up and how frequently he was gambling. But this is already like, really? Like, we're gambling on college soccer? I looked at the schedules. I think he was gambling on the women's team, which was like number three in the country, and they hadn't lost. So maybe he was betting on them because he was like, there's no way they're going to lose. And so then they that same day, they like draw 0-0 in double overtime against Oregon. And like, I guess this is, but again, like, this is our first detail of like, okay, Ipe is like gambling on very random stuff. And over the course of the next 14 months, you just are reading these texts where basically he's like, man, I'm not good at this. Oh, I need more. I need more. I need more. I need more. And it's really tough to read because it's like, yes, this is what addiction looks like. It is not rational. It makes no sense. The bookie, who is clearly preying on him, because whether or not Shohei had any idea, which I think we feel pretty good he had no idea, it's clear that the bookmaker was like, well, he's Otani's involved in some way. And so that's part of why he kept, you know, giving him the money.
Right. And we had talked about this, and I think a level of skepticism that people had when this all first came out was, why would a bookmaker extend so much credit to Ipe, who makes like $300,000 a year? And so at
less
the time,
than that,
I,
reportedly.
Less than that. Like, yeah. I said at the time, well, if the money's coming in and you know that this is an Otani-related guy, the bookie's not going to care, right? If the cash
is already
checks,
shady illegal operation, like, I don't, I mean,
right. If the check cashes, we're the cash check, if the check cashes, what's the difference, right? So I'm just gonna now read, actually, sorry, let me back up for a second. You're right, all the stuff where he's like, give me one last bump, give me one little bit more, give me another bit more credit, like, I'm so bad at this, haha, lol, like, oh, maybe I'll do a little bit more, this is the last. There's one text where it's like, this is the last one. Like, it reads like a bad script in a movie. It's really jarring how uncomfortable it is just to see. I do want to read this paragraph directly from it, okay? Directly from the report. The records reflect approximately 1,900 wagers between December 2021.
19,000. You said 1,900.
Oh, yeah, sorry. That is an important distinction. 1,900 is a lot, but 19,000 is outrageous. Reflect approximately 19,000 wagers between December 2021 and January 2024. Nearly 25 bets per day on average. The wagers reflected in the records ranged in value from roughly $10 to $160,000 per bet, with an average bet of roughly $12,800. During this period, the records reflect total winnings of $142 million and total losing bets of $182,935,206.68, leaving a total net balance of negative $40,678,436.94. That is the scale that we are talking about here. This is not little dribble drabble on the side, right? This is not, you know, throwing cash around for fun. This is like the GDP of a small island nation that he lost in total on games. Just outrageous stuff.
Yeah, and obviously, right, it's hard to wrap your mind around, right? You say, oh, it's making 19,000 bets and none of them are on baseball. Well, look, again, they have the log of everything he has bet on. They have that. Now, we don't have that. That's not public yet, right?
But, need it.
But let me say, I mean, I'd be listen, we could dig into just the one UCLA soccer bet. I'd be fascinated in all these other things. And I would know the original reporting said college football and international soccer and all those things, right, and college basketball, whatever.
Jordan, but anyway, going through and doing Ipe's worst beats.
I mean, but again, it's like he was also winning this much, but he gets so in the hole. And this is where also the story kind of takes a turn. Because by the end of 2023, middle of 2023, the bookie's like, you're essentially getting in too deep and you have not paid up fast enough, right? And so this is where Ipe is repeatedly being like, okay, like, I'm sorry, I can't pay it right now. Like, he's been paying, but it hasn't been, you know, fast enough, and he's getting in a deep enough, deep, too deep.
He does not have $40 million.
Right, right. And so it's getting worse and worse and worse. Then we get to this incredible excerpt, okay? I'm going to read this directly from the report. On or about November 17th, 2023, Bookmaker One messaged Mizuhara stating, hey, Ipe, it's 2 o'clock on Friday. I don't know why you're not returning my calls. I'm here in Newport Beach, and I see victim A, which is what they refer to Otani as in the report, walking his dog. I'm just going to go up and talk to him and ask how I can get in touch with you since you're not responding. Please call me back immediately. Okay, so this is a kind of a harrowing detail, which is essentially that this illegal bookie at least claimed in this message to have seen Otani in person and thus was like trying to reach Ipe and was like, well, I know he knows where Ipe is, so I'm going to go up to him.
Let's get one thing out of the way. Okay. If he did indeed see Otani, that is not an accident. Okay. There is no way that the bookie who's dealing with Ipe just stumbled into Shohei Otani walking his dog. Okay, so if this bookie didn't see Otani, it means he knew where Otani lived and walked his dog, and this is like a threat. Now,
yes.
Jordan, I think you made this point to me yesterday. Like, I do agree that maybe there's a chance this is not true, and he just sent it to Ipe to get Ipe to respond. Right. Either way, that it got to that point is just shocking and sad, and a reminder and that there's upsetting, and that there's like a dark side to this. If we're not already at the dark side already, like, this is an illegal criminal organization.
Exactly. Which brings us to the next update, which is where it really starts to get dangerous. I'm also going to read this directly from the report. On or about January 6th, this is what the January 6th everyone talks about. Bookmaker One messaged Mizuhara stating, quote, you're putting me in a position where this is going to get out of control. If I don't hear from you by the end of the day today, it's going to be out of my hands. Okay. Now we're getting into like, this is scary, horrifying. Like, what is he implying? Like, we're gonna have to come after you, right? I mean, that's what I'm reading. Maybe that's taking it too far, but like, this is what happens when you are getting too far in the hole with people that you shouldn't be getting in the hole with anyway, no matter what, right? Whether it's legal or not. Mizuhara responds, my bad, I just got back from Japan, I'm leaving tomorrow. Again, I'll be back in mid-January. To be honest with you, I'm really struggling right now and need some time before I start to make payments. So again, now we're in 2024, and at this point it's getting really, really ugly. Okay, it's getting to the point where, you know, Ipe's getting desperate. The bookmaker is not happy with him. All these things, right? And so at that point, it seems like he did manage to, over the next couple months, transfer another, you know, 500,000 or maybe a million or so over the last few months. But still, clearly, this is not going to be enough. And by this point, we're now already deep into the federal investigation. And now we're getting closer to the present day, which is now we can kind of get to the end of this report, and we'll back up and give some other details here, which is when it all kind of comes crashing down, I think is probably where we can go to next.
Otani's career earnings up to this point in his career, if you assume that like all of the Angels payroll stuff is going into his account, I mean, he it's made, like 40, I'm just doing a quick rough million. Estimate, about $70 million total. Million. Mm-hmm. From the Angels over his time, right? Minimum for two, ARB 3 mil, ARB 5.5, 30 mil, and 28 mil. Because he signed like that 2-year deal, remember? Like, if Ipe's down 40 mil, there's not 40 mil to give, right? Like I just, and so
Well, right. And so from the documents, we know that he managed to steal, because right, the original number we had saw was 4.5. And then eventually it seems the number that is presented in terms of the amount that was actually stolen from the bank is around 16 million.
Right. But he was never going to get up to the amount that he needed to pay.
No way.
And so that's kind of why, you know, you start to see him realize that he cannot pay his way out of the situation. And that's where it kind of starts to spiral a little bit more.
And then, which again, we get to the end where essentially at the very end, you know, now we're in March and I'll just read the last page of the report. On or about March 17th, Mizuhara messaged bookmaker stating, quote, thank you for the call earlier. Do you think there's any way to find out the details of the article that's coming out in the LA Times? Okay, so he at this point, it's like, oh, they're on to me. Or at least they know something's coming because they must have reached out to him, right? The LA Times reached out to Ipe. At this point, they're deep into it. Bookmaker responded to Mizuhara the same day stating, quote, hey, bud, of course, thank you for calling me. I have no idea what this idiot is printing or trying to say. I've never spoke to him. Wasn't willing to talk to him, although he tried. All my attorney did was give him those facts I told you. I told him the rest you won't talk about. Can't confirm or deny anything. He did say his source was the FBI. I don't even know if that's true. 3 days later, on or about March 20th, again, this is like while they're in Korea, Mizuhara messaged Bookmaker stating, have you seen the reports? Bookmaker once responds, yes, that's all bullshit. Obviously, you didn't steal from him. I understand it's a cover job. I totally get it. Mizuhara responds, technically, I did steal from him. It's all over for me. So, the bookmaker saying, obviously, you didn't steal. I understand it's a cover up. That seems to be the bookie being like, this is what I assumed to be the case all along, that you were just doing it for him. And then Ipe's like, no, I stole from him. So that's it.
Yeah.
And then as we know, that is when eventually, he returns back to the US, he's basically the government seizes his phone and everything. And the investigation kind of, it goes from there. And now here we are a few weeks later.
Any other little snippets that we brushed past? I would say there's
one other major thing we need to talk about.
Well, there's just the one goofy one is the baseball card stuff where Ipe was just spending a lot of Ohtani's money on baseball cards. And that's just like an investment to try and spin money forward, to try and make money from money very quickly.
Yes. And that is something that was seemingly happening like in the last couple months. There is that Shohei Ipe was basically trying to order a bunch of baseball cards, $300,000 worth of baseball cards that in theory he probably thought he could flip this in some amount of time as he's thinking about how he's going to get out of this millions and millions of debt, right? So that seemed to be the mindset there. But, you know, it's an interesting detail. It's like that he was buying a bunch of Yogi Berra and Juan Soto and Ohtani cards, but that it seems, and that's what is implied by, you know, Chris Seymour. He's like, yeah, that's clearly what was happening here.
But the key point I think that you're referring to is that Ipe, as the translator and the conduit between Ohtani and Nesbolelo,
yes,
the agent at CAA, Ohtani's agent.
Yes.
And the conduit between Ohtani and his like financial advisors and the tax people, the accountants, whatever. Ipe lied to those people and said that Ohtani wanted this account that Ipe then had control over to be private, right? Now, some credit to this, you know, these financial people is like they understood that that put them in an uncomfortable tax situation where if there were gifts leaving that account or it accrued interest, they were liable for, you know, tax problems. But Ipe said, oh, that's not happening in this account. Don't worry. Ohtani wants it to be private. Not a big deal. CAA and Bolelo and those financial people were handling the finances and the money that came in from endorsement stuff, I believe. And so they had control over a significant portion of the money that Ipe did not have access to directly, which kind of, I would imagine, made this get to this point. Like there was money that they saw, a significant amount of it, right? Yep. However, I agree with you, this is the hardest thing to read because it is Ipe blatantly flat out lying to people who are trying, though not enough, to look after Ohtani.
Yeah. And that's what's so hard is because it's like, it doesn't make CAA and you know, their group look good, the fact that they trusted everything that Ipe ever said, that everything was funneled through him, and the fact that as late as 2022, when we know Ipe already has access to that account, that he says, like, there's a part where they were supposed to have a meeting together and just Ipe showed up and was like, Ohtani's sick, sorry. Like, there's just a lot of clear, just straight up deception, right? And telling them, and they said, you know, this excerpt here, agent was aware of the account and asked Mizuhara on multiple occasions about the account. Mizuhara told agent that the account was private and that victim A did not want anyone else to monitor that account. Agent said he did not confirm these representations directly with victim A, Ohtani, but stated that he had no reason not to believe Mizuhara. And that is the thing that is the grand takeaway of all of this, which is that so much of Ohtani's life had been entrusted. And we knew this from the beginning of this story, but like to hear it, to see it confirmed by everyone around him, even the people that we thought would also be closest to him and have access to him and actually be the ones entrusted to protect him. Instead, all along the way, Ipe was the one essentially shielding them from the full story. And while Shohei did say, okay, well, this is still Shohei being negligent with his money, I think that's still a somewhat fair take. But again, he had just wanted Ipe to handle everything. And so he assumed that he would be keeping him in the loop on all things, including his personal account, including his you know, investments and endorsement accounts. But there was a wall. There was a wall here that Ipe was holding up, and that there's evidence here of him keeping that wall up in ways that is so problematic and so sad and so troubling. And the word that Shohei used himself when he spoke to the media a few weeks ago is betrayal and lies. And that is when Ohtani, who cooperated with this investigation, that's another five pages of this, is what Ohtani tells the investigator, is that no, he had no idea about any of this. He doesn't recognize the email account that's associated with his bank and all these things. And yeah, you can say, well, then dude, you got to keep track of your money. He thought he had enough people that were doing that. And because Ipe was the conduit, that was not a safe thing to trust. And that is the real tragedy of this whole thing.
Life requires trust. Like, we can't move through society without putting our trust in other people. Like, Jordan, you could steal tens of thousands of dollars from me if you wanted to. Certainly not 16 million, but I got that locked away.
No. Yeah.
You know, like, we put our trust in people, and Ohtani put his trust in Ipe because he needed someone to be his conduit to the world. Yeah. If Ohtani had multiple translators that we knew about for security purposes, I think that's the type of thing that we would have like dunked on him for being paranoid. Right.
I mean, yeah, now, I don't know. I mean, again, like this situation, I'm sure will. I mean, it's hard to say, like, this situation is so extreme that it's like, on one hand, it's like, OK, here are the lessons we can learn. On the other hand, it's like, oh, my gosh, like, this is such an absurd and like horrible and singular, unique situation because of their relationship, that there's no way that any version of this can be replicated. Now, of course, people have pointed out, like, yeah, celebrities get their money stolen from them all the time. Like, this people that have money, they get taken advantage of often. Now, that doesn't, there's levels of empathy and there's levels of understanding with these things. And, you know, the real reality of this is, of course, Ohtani's going to be fine. He's not, it's not like all of his money's gone and like he's going to be okay. But it's just sad. It's the only person he really had this relationship with. And again, like, this is also in the report. As noted above, the investigative team and I have spoken with and reviewed an extraction of the Mizuhara phone, which contained voluminous messages between victim A and Mizuhara in Japanese. An HSI special agent who is fluent and native speaker of the Japanese language reviewed approximately 9,700 pages of text messages between victim A and Mizuhara between 2020 and 2024.
If
and
you want to read 37 pages of the report, think about the guy who read 9,700 pages of text messages.
Yeah. Yeah, 9,000 pages. Like, it's just, okay, and there's no evidence of Shohei having any idea about any of this. And so, it's all there. It's horribly sad. If you still want to say that, oh, he's clearly just a fall guy, he's just going to go take 30 years for him in jail, like, I don't know what to tell you. My main takeaway here is that this – we laid out the scenarios when we talked about this originally a few weeks ago. And this one, option B, as we were calling it at the time, where – it is just as bad as it could possibly be from Ipe's state perspective is what it has turned out to be, if not even worse. And that's sad. It's really sad.
Yeah.
And I obviously, you know, maybe we will still get some more details in the future. But as far as I'm concerned, this report and the details and the fact that he's pleading guilty is kind of puts a capper on this for me.
Puts a capper on this for me from the what is Ohtani's culpability?
Yeah.
I mean, that special agents reviewed every text message between Ohtani and Ipe over the course of 4 years and found zero evidence of communication about gambling between the two of them is incredibly important, because it is not like Ipe was using discretion to talk about gambling. If he was comfortable texting the bookie, LOL, lost 10,000 on UCLA soccer, feels like he would have just texted Ohtani about bets as well. And so for me, we have a trove of evidence that Ipe was involved, and we have absolutely zero indication that Ohtani knew anything about it. And until we are given evidence that proves it otherwise, I'm going to sit here and I am going to believe Ohtani and his side of the story, because what we have learned is so overwhelmingly indicating that is the case.
Yep. And, yeah, it's still like, if you want to say there's still a level of negligence from his side, from his agent's side, like I hear all that, like that's fine. But that's different than that. And it's still messy, right? It's still the bigger zooming all the way out. Like, it is still a reminder that, like, again, the gambling issues like this are, even if they're tangentially associated, unfortunately, indirectly, like these are still scary things that we're going to be confronting in sports moving forward, for sure. I just think that this is a singularly unique, horrible case of betrayal and lying. And that's what the story is. So I think we have to kind of move forward from there.
I agree. All right. Read it. Yeah. Go read it.
Yeah. It's, I mean, again, time. Like, it's, if you've been interested in this story, like you will learn a lot. It's tough to read at times for sure, but it's all there, and we'll see what other details. I mean, again, hopefully this is the last time we talk about this for 40 minutes on the podcast. You know, maybe that changes, but I think to get this amount of detail feels good in some way, I guess.
Yeah, we can finally spin it forward. Jordan, one last thing. You know, Ohtani's name is not in this.
Yeah.
And I had this moment yesterday laughing about someone who saw this document and was like, oh my God, who's the player? It's like, okay, so they were in,
all right,
they Southern were California. In Southern California in 2018. Mm-hmm. Ooh, could it be Max Stassi? Like, is it, like, who is it? Right.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Mm-hmm. I'm glad they protected his identity in this account. It's very respectful. But yeah, so that's where we're at on that. If we, again, like, if you feel like we're missing something, like, it's still an interesting thing to talk about, but obviously this feels like we're getting some level of closure. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com if you have any further thoughts. If there's something you feel like we misrepresented or oversimplifying or got wrong, like, let us know. You know, we're doing our best with this, but we read the whole thing, so hopefully that is a good place to start for anybody that wants to talk about this.
Pay your taxes. All right, Jake. All right, after this, it is April 12th. Let's take a quick break. And when we return, I will walk you through the Jackson holiday debut, and we will do the good, the bad, and the ugly. And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, George Houston. Let's talk about the sport.
Yay.
Instead of baseball. Crime.
Shohei Ohtani, by the way, still playing baseball. And he's playing pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, we said that was going to happen. This is not a man who gets distracted at all. I have to say, not to stick it on Ohtani, if he had sucked like for the first 3 weeks, I'd be like, maybe he did it. But he's been cooking. Not a care in the world. Man. I'm obviously kidding.
So good.
Jordan. Yeah. I was in Boston yesterday,
sure.
And if you listen to this show, you know my general distaste for going to Boston.
And good place to start.
And so I only go there when I need to or when I want to. And Jackson Holliday's debut for the Baltimore Orioles at Fenway Park.
Cleared
definitely
the bar.
Qualified. Definitely cleared the bar. Wednesday evening, top prospect in baseball, 20 years old, the son of MLB All-Star Matt Holliday, number one overall pick in 2022. He is many things to many people. And for the first time, he played in a major league game. And I was fortunate enough to witness his 0 for 4.
You did it. You were there. And him dropping a pop-up. Wow. He looked
didn't
great.
Drop it. He didn't drop the pop-up. He just didn't catch the pop-up. It hit.
Yeah. It was somewhere in between because he looked like, you're right. It didn't clang off the glove. That's dropping.
That's
it.
A drop to me.
But there was like a still frame where it was like, oh, he's going to catch that. And then I was like, oh, no, he didn't. And that's because he's overrated and bad. That was my takeaway from the first two games of Jackson Holliday. What was your takeaway?
Yeah, I agree. All right. I think we can move on. Again, he's 20. And our expectations for these children playing Major League Baseball are always way too high. Adley Rutschman was pretty bad for the first month and a half. And he was, I believe, 24 when he debuted. Gunnar Henderson, who debuted last year. Or I guess he debuted 2 years ago at the end of the season. But his first full season last year, he was bad for 2 months and then won Rookie of the Year. Like, guys start slow. Mike Trout was ass that first season when he was up. Like, I am not worried about 2 games of Jackson Holliday, and neither should you. No,
but I will say, though, last night, I know you weren't at the second game, but when he struck out against Kenley Jansen, it was a great reminder of, like, you can't prepare for seeing the Kenley Jansen cutter for the first time. There's literally nothing he can do. And this is why you do eventually just rush the guys to the big leagues. Because, like, listen, this is where they're going to figure it out. the best version of big league pitchers, it doesn't know whether they're lefty or righty. They don't exist in the International League. And so you have to go through that. You have to strike out against Kenley Jansen. You have to get it frustrated. And then you have to figure it out. And guess what? He's 20. He's going to.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote about this at
Yahoo, just go read what Jake wrote because it was very good.
Holliday is a fascinating thing for many reasons. He exemplifies like what it means to have the privilege and access that enables player development. And he had more of it than like anybody else maybe has ever had with like a batting cage facility. Like he had, like, you know, TrackMan in his backyard and like his dad's Matt Holliday. And so, but I think like the biggest advantage for him in that regard is that just none of this is going to faze him and that he grew up around this and that he has expectations, but he's not going to like, he's not someone I worry about. We talked about this before he debuted, like the final stat line, at least this season, I don't think he's going to overwhelm, but I just expect him to be a competent and contributing member of the 2024 Baltimore Orioles.
Yeah.
And the debut itself was cool. Like to see Matt there was very fun, right? Like, and Ethan, the little brother, who's one of the top picks for next year, is there. And oh my God, he's enormous.
Yeah.
He looks like, Ethan looks like Matt, and Jackson looks like Leslie, the Matt's wife.
Hmm. Oh, interesting. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I think like, it's just so cool. And then last night, you know, when you have the Colton Cowser breakout game, it's just like, this is the nature of, and Gunnar, you know, when Jackson strikes out, you know, to end the ninth, and then Gunnar comes up, he's like, I got you, bro. Watch. This is how it's done, right? And that'll probably be Jackson Holliday in a year and a half, where he's one of the best players in baseball. But for now, it's like one game, 2 games in, it's like, oh, Major League Baseball's hard. It's fine.
And the Orioles don't need him to be great.
Yeah.
Like, they won 101 games last year without him.
They need him to be better than Tony Kemp. And God bless Tony Kemp, who had one of the classiest tweets of all time
ever
after getting DFA'd, where and he's basically, yeah,
let's be clear, okay, that's why the Orioles went and got Tony Kemp, because they did not want any sort of discord to fester when someone was jettisoned right away for Jackson Holliday, and I'm sure they knew that Tony Kemp would handle it in the manner he did. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, debuts are always cool. This one was really cool. Like, you could feel the significance of it in the park. There were so many Orioles fans there that came up to Boston. The home debut, which is going to be today against Milwaukee, will be similarly cool. Just keep an eye on it. Go read what I wrote at Yahoo. Jackson Holliday.
There you go. All right. It is time for the good, the bad, the ugly. Our weekly look around the league. Something good, something bad, something Dan Ugla. Something that you're not thinking about, but maybe should be. That's Dan Ugla. We describe it a little bit differently every week, but that's how I'm describing it this week. Jake, what was good for you this week?
The Boston Red Sox are in dire straits right now. However, Jordan, there is a ray of sunshine peeking through the clouds of gray. And that comes from a hero named Joey Capone. Now, Joey Capone works at SI inside the Red Sox, does a bunch of Red Sox stuff. Joey Capone has started tweeting out what are AI-generated country songs about the 2024 Boston Red Sox. And I generally believe that like parody songs about Major League Baseball are cringy. These absolutely slap-a-roni. And we're going to just play one for you right now so you can enjoy the magic. How do you lose to a team of children? How come
nothing good ever happens to us? So now listen, whether it's AI, whether it's AI with him producing the music, I don't know exactly the details. I have a feeling we are going to find out soon exactly how these are made because they are going around. I mean, it's not just us retweeting them. I mean, my goodness, people are quote tweeting left and right because they are truly hilarious. And if this is AI, this is a good, you know, we found a good use of it because this is just hilarious. This is amazing. This is to be able to express your fandom and your consternation through this
in such a productive way
is so great. Right. This is just because you're bringing joy to more people than just tweeting like, ugh, I hate my team.
Right.
This is so much better.
Great pain makes great art.
Yeah. That is sick. Could you possibly find a better example of this than that? All right. That's anything else? I mean, yes. There's multiple of these. They're so good. I hope he keeps making them, and I'm excited to find out more about them. So
I hope the Red Sox don't win another game all year so that we can.
That was the other funny thing with their loss last night was, you know, I'm sure many broadcasters, opposing broadcasters will do this all year where Kevin Brown was like, oh, this is going to be an interesting chapter of the Netflix. It's like I said this since the beginning. Listen. That might be 30 seconds. Like, this is the thing about doing a Netflix talk for a baseball season. There's so much. There's so much content. I don't even know how you're going to distill it.
You could, like, see it when I was there. Like, there's this one guy who's, like, the main producer who's, like, in charge. And he's just, like, everywhere. Like, he was in the press box. And then he was, like, running across the field in between innings. Yeah. Like, it's very visible. I can't wait for it to come out. Jordan, what's good for you, buddy?
Lots to choose from this week. I mean,
Can I guess what you're going to do?
Mason Miller throwing 104. Yeah, but I'm not doing Mason Miller. I'll come back to Mason Miller. He's incredible. And oh my God. But the Royals, I mean, to go from mopping the White Sox, it's like, all right, good. You mopped the White Sox. I'm glad. And then it's like, oh, the Astros are coming to town. Oh, I know the Astros are scuffling, but it's like, it's the Astros. They're better than the White Sox, right? Surely you won't be able to, you know, smack the Astros around the same way. Not only did they smack the Astros, they whooped them even worse than the White Sox. They walk off on Tuesday, and then they just blitz them on Wednesday 10-2. And then on Thursday, poor Hunter Brown, for some reason, thought he was in a competition with last year's Carlos Rodon to have the worst start in baseball history, allows, I believe, 11 hits. Is this correct?
In one inning.
This guy allowed 11 hits in one inning, which should not even be possible. 11 hits and a walk. And the only reason they allowed him to stay out there is because the Astros pitching is already so thin because of injuries. They've had all these up and down and all these ridiculous things. He doesn't make it out of the first inning. The Royals sweep the Astros. The Royals have one of the best pitching staffs in baseball. And the Royals are 9-4. Bobby Witt Jr. looks like the MVP. They have a team ERA of 2.54. Their starting pitching ERA is under 2. They look amazing. They look great. I don't know if they're going to, you know, win 100 games, but I've seen enough to think it's hard to imagine the Royals being bad. So I don't know how good they are, but I think they're closer to good than bad. So long way to go. Nice to see Vinny finally get going this week after his cold start, but I'm excited to watch this team. They're fun.
Whooping the snot out of the Astros is a good thing. That's good. That's better than the alternative. So.
Yes. What's bad, though? I mean, the bad could just, like, I kind of want to just do the Astros because they suck, but right now. But I'll skip that. What do you have for bad this week?
I want to talk about this WFAN rant from Sal Licata. Mm-hmm. I don't always love to give oxygen to these sports talk radio yelling matches, but this one was so good and bad that I needed to give it some air. Basically, the take is that, the context, the Yankees, who have been awesome, and Juan Soto, who has been awesome. Soto was up in the bottom of the ninth, two outs, runners on first and second as the tying run. They were down three. And instead of just, you know, hitting a home run to tie it, why don't you just do that, dude? Soto drew a full count walk, setting up the bases loaded for noted scrub Aaron Judge, who flew out to center field to end the game. And Juan Soto, it's amazing. The take is basically that, you got a pitcher on the ropes, first and second, and a spot right there. You need to do damage. You need Soto to do damage. A walk. He's looking for a walk, bro. That you get paid to swing the bat. I don't care if he's a Yankee or a Met. I cannot accept a walk in that spot that does not get the job done. Passing the baton is not what we're looking for from Juan Soto. I'm looking for him to do some damage.
Well, then there's another part. I think the next part is where he says, when Judge is struggling, it's like, dude. So you're basically saying, this is just like an all-time insult to Aaron Judge, where you're like, if Judge is struggling, he's useless. He might as well not be on the team. Passing the bat to Aaron Judge, one of the greatest baseball players of his generation, you would think anyone watching the Yankees would be familiar with his work.
He's talking like he's Isaiah Kiner-Falefa.
I know. It's like even struggling, Judge, like he's useless. He's hopeless. Passing the bat to Aaron Judge, who's struggling, is a waste of time. And honestly, you might as well forfeit the game instead of doing that.
What are we doing? Like, Juan Soto has an OPS over 1,000. He has done everything you could have possibly hoped for so far in his time as a Yankee. And we're complaining that he's walking? That's the point of Juan Soto. That's like the whole thing. If you want someone to swing the bat, trade for Javier Baez, okay?
Yeah, I'll see how that works out for you.
And I just love how quickly they got point that, yeah, like, New York
Even
Sports Talk Radio
working.
Just, oh my God, it couldn't help himself. Just the short-sightedness. Like, they lost 1 out of 3 to the Marlins, and Aaron Judge was up as the winning run. Like, okay. And I think what I loved about this is that even Yankee fans, right, who we sometimes get on for being irrational, clearly understand that this take is just unhinged.
Yeah, that's great.
And beyond the pale. So, like, you know what?
Good work.
This is actually a good take because it's so funny. It's clearly not satire, but
I know. But, like, whenever I watch people, like, deliver these, like, I look really closely. I'm like, you see this with, like, honestly, like,
Russo.
Mad Dog? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes when Russo's like going ham, you can kind of tell he's like, this is funny. Like, I know, like, I'm doing my job. But this one, he's like, he seems very serious. He's very upset about this. Like, yeah, you can't pass the bat to a struggling Aaron Judge. I mean, that's what
you can't. It's irresponsible.
My bad. It is Astros. Jake, they're 4-10. Jose Abreu has a -31 OPS plus.
Oh, so he's better than last year?
Not quite. He's trending in that direction. Alex Bregman has a .638 OPS. The pitching staff is just in total shambles. Besides Ronel Blanco, who's, you know, the best pitcher we've ever seen, Javier's been good. Doesn't seem like the Frommer injury is that serious, but, like, still a little bit worried there. But yeah, no, they're in a bad place. They are, and not only are they in a bad place, Jake. The reason really why I want to highlight this, they're in a bad place, and now they go home, and who's coming to town? Texas and Atlanta. In back-to-back series. So, like, if they just lose both of those series, they are going to be 6-15, 6-14. This is the first time they've been 4-9 since 2013. Now they're 4-10. Remember the 2013 Astros?
They were not as good as
They lost 111 games. So, listen, are they going to lose 111 games? I don't think so. But, boy, oh, boy, do they look poopy.
I will say they're not this bad, but the Astros apparatus is slowly rotting away from the core. There was an interview that Reggie Jackson did with Joel Sherman and John Heyman where he was basically like offering a peek behind the curtain. And it's clear that like the days of Jeff Lunau, who had many issues, but clearly knew how to build up an organization.
Yeah, or James
Click. James Click, who did a phenomenal job. Like those days are long gone. because it's Reggie Jackson, Jeff Bagwell, Craig Biggio, and the owner.
Occasionally Dana Brown, I guess, giving his input, and like whoever's still working in the analytics group being like, hey guys, like maybe we should do this. And they're like, I'm Jeff Bagwell. So sorry. Yeah. We have, you know, 700 home runs here. That's a little bit more important than you going to Dartmouth. Now,
those guys like have probably very important insight when it comes to certain things. I don't want to completely dismiss it, but like at the same time, I'm worried about the Astros, I have to say. Like I think they will be absolute ass within like three or four years. Like this is what made them amazing is that they were a sustainable operation that like kept the window open, right? The second wave of like Yordan and Kyle Tucker and even like Chaz McCormick and Fromber, like those are all guys who weren't on the 2017 team when they were coming up. That's a big window, and it's a window that should be celebrated, and it's amazing and impressive, but the process has changed to the point where I'm pessimistic.
Yeah, I'm pessimistic too. I mean, listen, there's still a ton of talent here, and there's still a lot that they've obviously done right in terms of talent acquisition and identifying player development, but the infrastructure here is in a not so great place. Ugla, what you got for Ugla?
The Cleveland Guardians are getting in the way.
Getting in the way?
Of baseballs. So far this season,
about
2 weeks in, the Cleveland Guardians have 16 hit by pitches in 12 games. Okay. 16 hit by pitches in 12 games. That is five more than the second place team, the Minnesota Twins, who have 11 in 10 games. The Philadelphia Phillies have one in 13 games, which is fascinating to me because it's probably like, they really want to get out of the way. Like they're very incentivized to get out of the way because they don't have a lot of offensive depth. And so they're just like,
Pop quiz. Know? Who's the one Phillies hit by pitch?
It has to be Whit Merrifield.
Good guess. No, it's Johan Rojas. Again, he's trying to get on base any way he can. So,
okay. Anyway, the Guardians have 16 hit by pitches. Andres Jimenez has five of them.
He's pretty good at getting plunked. That's part of his like secret OBP powers.
Ramon Laureano has five of them. And just the reason I bring this up is I know it's early and it's probably unlikely sustainable, but the all-time record for hit-by-pitches in a season was set by the 2022 Mets, who had 112. Mm-hmm. The Seattle Mariners last year at 111, falling just short of history.
Ty France this had 105 of those. So
yeah, felt exactly. Like the Mets last year at 107. So like the Mets, the last two seasons were 1-3 all-time. All of these records are like in the last handful of years. Like the most of my pitches are recent, and that's just because pitchers have worse control and command because they're throwing harder. But these Guardians, if they keep on this pace, could be doing some magic. And Cleveland as an offense is like very much incentivized to not get out of the way because they just have so few players who like do damage that aren't named Naylor. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to keep an eye on this. This is pretty ugly.
Great call. Jimenez he had 25 a couple years ago. Laureano's had a bunch. So Jimenez, those two alone is going to put you in pretty strong position. All right. My ugly Jake is related to Division III baseball. For those of you who don't know this, but when we have time, which we don't anymore, we like to talk and podcast about Division III baseball. But this is just makes me laugh so much. So basically, last week I saw some news that a gentleman by the name of Frankie Ritter, who is a shortstop at Shenandoah University, set the all-time record, career record for hits for a Division III baseball player. Now, the reason why this is happening, not that Frankie Ritter is not very good, as you know, for everyone who follows the Hornets and the ODAC knows this, but when COVID happened in Division I athletics, as many people know, there was a waiver, right? If 2020 season, you got an extra year of eligibility because the 2020 season got wiped out. However, in Division III, you got 2 years of eligibility because the 2021 season at the Division III level was impacted much more. And the 2021 season was also very goofy. It wasn't just canceled, but it was so unbalanced and everything that they decided to give two extra years.
Some teams didn't play at all. Some conferences play at all. It was just wonky as hell.
And so because of that, you have players at the D3 level, and I've seen this in basketball too, putting up absurd career stat lines because they are playing more games than anyone has ever played at the Division III baseball level. And so Frankie Ritter setting the hits record was amazing. But the reason why this is ugly is because they did a whole like press release. Frankie Ritter sets the hits record, only to find out that there is another player right now who also just broke the hits record because he too is in his sixth year of D3 baseball. And that is Joe Ruth at LaGrange, who of course you are familiar with. But the reason why this is ugly is because this has happened in D3 before, where a record has been broken by my college roommate. It was an on-base streak that everyone said, oh, you set this record, only for a school to be like, hey, actually, no, we have this record. And I'm just thinking about this in an MLB context of like records that just are kept so obscurely that it's like someone has to alert them like, hey, no, actually, like imagine like Aaron Judge, you know, hits his 60-second home run and they're like, oh, no, sorry, wait, no, there's actually this guy that nobody has talked about. Nobody knew about this. He actually hit 65 home runs in the American League. So, and you didn't find out about it until 2 days after he hit the home run. Like, it's just the best. So anyway, and then the other thing is just Joe Ruth and Frankie Ridder now still have, you know, 15, 20 games left, and they're going back and forth. They're practically tied in career hits. So both of those teams, you know, on, you know, South Region Division III powerhouses are going to try and keep those careers alive. Their career started in 2019 and they basically played like every game since then. So yeah. There you go.
There's a lot we didn't get to. Mason Miller, Cal Raleigh owning the Blue Jays, Mike Trout's having another kid, Jordan Montgomery telling Boris to pound sand and getting a new agency after Boris biffed his most recent free agency situation. Lot to get to there. I want to talk about Montgomery next week. Like that I do think is significant and important, but we are well over time today after all the Ohtani Mishigas. Jordan Schusterman, I hope you have a phenomenal, phenomenal weekend. A lot of good series on the docket.
Yep.
I will not be watching a whole lot of them because it is my lovely fiance's birthday.
Oh, baby.
So I will put baseball on the back burner.
All right.
For love.
Well, happy birthday.
That's what we do.
Happy birthday to Tamar. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. And we will be back on Monday with another episode of Baseball Barbacast. Have a good weekend. Goodbye.